This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 7th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Happy 2014 to one and all. To kick off the year that Cape Town celebrates being World Design Capital, we head to Taipei to discuss the next city that will take up the crown.
From now on, government will think to cooperate with designers and also communicate with public citizens.
We meet a new crop of designers tearing up the seams of the Turkish fashion scene.
Design-wise, we can play with men's world a lot. And we can create new things, and there are still so many things that weren't made or done for men right now. We want this the old Istanbul gentleman back.
And then we discuss how better design can help our cities prepare themselves for natural disasters.
The design of elements against known strains and stresses is certainly something that becomes more and more sophisticated with all of our new tools.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. The steep hillsides that line the Bosphorus in Istanbul have long attracted writers, intellects and artists. But what about fashion designers? How is the city's melange of influences from around the Middle East and Europe affected local fashion? A new generation of designers is exploring Istanbul's many layers in order to find inspiration grounded in time-honoured Turkish craft techniques and adherence to the principle that quality always trumps quantity. With designs infused with Istanbul's briny complexion, they are creating the opposite of fast fashion. From the antique sellers of Beyoglu to the markets of Kadıköy, Monocle's Joseph Dana ventured out into Istanbul with some of these designers to discover how the fashion scene is developing in Turkey.
On a small side street, on the European side of Istanbul, one can step back in time. The street is filled with antique shops and vintage buildings, some of which have seen better days. Among locals, the street is known for having three Turkish baths, or hammams. Since Turkish baths are the foundation of men's cosmetics here, it should come as no surprise that this street is home to one of Turkey's most exciting menswear design teams.
It's first of all, I think, as I said, this world is undiscovered.
That is Bahar Gorskin, one of the partners of Civan, a clothing line and boutique based in the Cukurkuma neighborhood of Istanbul. I asked her why she chose men's fashion to start with.
We are not really into, you know, dressing up women because it's not that much interesting for us. In a way that, we can play with technically also, and design-wise, we can play with men's world a lot. And we can create new things, and there are still so many things that weren't made or done for men right now, and especially in Turkey that it's a different statement for men what we do here now. But also as we said before, that the arts craft and the artisan feeling of this street and of the city is also affected on this. We want this the old Istanbul gentleman back in the streets.
Civan's small boutique feels like a slice of the early 1920s. Set amidst a myriad of carpets, boxes of buttons, and posters from old Constantinople, there is a cozy table. The message is clear. This is not a shop where you can hide in the dressing room. The selection of clothing and patterns is a group effort, best done over cups of strong tea. This rejection of speed in the fashion process, from tailoring to selection, is at the heart of Civan's approach to fashion. Civan, by the way, means good-looking in Turkish. Bahar Gorskin, again.
But also, as he said, it's a slow process. It's not like fast fashion. So once people have something tailored for themselves, they cannot throw it away the next season. That's impossible. They will keep it in their wardrobe because they know that, you know, there is a craft inside, that it's made by hands, and it's made exactly for his body and for his shape and for his measures. And it took like a week or 2 weeks to finish a jacket for him, you know. So it's not something easy to throw away the next season. So we have this attitude against fast fashion.
Istanbul's subdued complexion has long lent itself to intellectual passions. Perhaps it has to do with the waterways that surround the city, or the fact that this was once the capital of an empire. With history comes vintage. Whether it be buildings, language, or clothing, Istanbul is infused with a vintage sensibility. For Koray Connor, a fashion writer based in Istanbul, vintage is more than just old clothes. It signifies quality and craftsmanship.
Actually, it has always been with us till now. You know, the retro thing, the vintage thing, we are surrounded by those because, you know, as Turkish people, we don't like to throw out our clothes. You know, we love keeping them. I have lots of pieces from my father, from my grandfather, in my closet as well. And I'm still keeping a good, great quality coat from, like, I think 50s. And, you know, we love mixing it up.
Turkey has long been a center of clothing manufacturing due to its ideal location between Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia. While clothes might be produced in Turkey, Turkish designers have faced an uphill battle in the international fashion world. It is due to this relative isolation that a label like Givan can be so iconoclastic. For Kerem Jukuray, the other partner in Givan, they are creating an entirely new sensibility for Turkish men through their approach and designs.
Now, industry copying old techniques, and we don't like it, old images. Also, we really like to make real vintage, we can say it vintage, but we really wanted to make it in true way. Also, you can change your attitude, you can choose your colors, you can live the experience in rehearsal, and you can live the process, you can wait for the dress for days, and you can choose the fabrics, and you can change the buttons. This is the process what we designed first.
As we peeked inside the various nooks and crannies of Jivan's inviting shop, I asked to see one of their favorite designs. While they only started in 2012, Jivan already has 5 collections. Bahar Guskin showed me the democracy shirt.
So whatever you see in the front of a shirt, you see the same detail on the back side as well. So the front side and the back side is the same. That is a very humorous shirt. Also the same details with the bow ties that... We make a bow in the front of the shirt, and the same bow is on the back side as well. So when the first time we fit the shirt during the fitting, our friend put it on, and he was just looking at me, and I asked him to turn around. He turned around, and I started laughing. It's a funny shirt. There's something intelligent behind that.
It is long overdue that a wave of fashion designers are using the streets of Istanbul to stimulate new collections driven by a deep ethic of craftsmanship and respect for Turkish tailoring. Along with many of the changes happening in Istanbul, designers like Jivan are embracing the past in order to look to the future at the crossroads of East and West. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Coming up, we review the big design stories coming out of the US of A.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Let's look at the news coming out of the East Coast of America. Design journalist and Section D stalwart Dan Rubenstein joins me from our New York bureau to run us through some of the big design stories in the US. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank you. I mean, you're in New York, but let's pop on down to the south of the country. And Miami, another bit of quite sort of heavy design news coming out of there, isn't there?
Yeah, so soon after Design Miami had Art Basel Miami Beach had its big splash in December, comes news that Alan Faena, who is a developer in Argentina, is planning his own Faena district. He's already recruited the talents of Heatherwick, and now he's turning to Norman Foster and Rem Koolhaas to design multiple projects, including renovating the 1948 Saxony Hotel mm-hmm. with directors Baz Luhrmann to give it sort of a Great Gatsby reimagining, if you will. There's also a $1 billion 47-unit tower with penthouses going for $50 million a piece. That is supposed to be completed by the end of 2014. And Rem Koolhaas is also designing an art center, which will also have an artist residency program there. Mm. So it really does seem like the people have learned the lessons from people behind the Craig Robbins and DACRA, who are behind the Miami Design District, yeah. and really are trying to not just develop, but to also bring brand name architects and to really infuse cultural programming and arts programming into real estate development, which seems to be sort of the magic catchphrase nowadays. You can't have a hotel now without a cultural curator or some sort of cultural programming going on. It just doesn't seem to be, it seems to be not worth it if you're not doing that. So this is truly on a whole new level. I can't imagine how an 18-story tower could cost $1 billion unless it was built on top of the Mona Lisa, but that's we'll have to wait and see how that turns out.
Yeah, I don't know, Rem Koolhaas has said, culture is at the core of the vision and driving force of Fine in Miami Beach, isn't it? But I mean, all these big names involved, what do you actually think of the actual art buildings? I mean, they're quite sort of, I mean, very Miami in style.
I think people are all wondering the same thing, is will Miami become the sort of Dubai of yeah. America? By definition, you don't really want architecture that stands out too much. You know, Miami does have a historical context to its architecture. You can't go too far outside. There is a whitewashed look that Miami needs to have. It's on the water. It's, for most of the year, bright, super bright and sunny. So not everything is going to work, but a lot of it, you know, it would look perfectly at home in that area. And it all seems well and good. It doesn't seem too much out of place. You know,
I guess it's Miami, which is a city that's sort of known for this kind of historically a sort of wonderland approach to architecture. I guess this is all quite fitting that, you know, if you did it in New York or San Francisco or wherever, it might not fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Miami has its own set of rules that it has to apply by. Mm. And this seems to be going, you know, to be directly on message.
Yeah. And just, you know, another couple of fantastic names involved in a city that's sort of quickly becoming the epicenter of great American building.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, Sufjanoto, Herzog & de Moore have recently done projects there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as an American, the only thing I'd like to see are more American architects.
Yeah.
And more American names in a city such as this, who can be more involved in the cultural programming we all hear so much about, especially, you know, considering that Miami isn't really going to have much of a future if it doesn't have a homegrown community of its own architects and designers and creatives. And so if all the talent comes from overseas, if all the brands come from overseas, there is a chance that over time people could just get bored of it and then not yeah. pay too much attention to it. And so we'll see.
And across the West Coast now, I mean, Apple are on the brink of a major new launch, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. The desktop Mac computer, the Power Mac, that anyone who's ever worked in a graphic designer studio or in any sort of creative office, those towers are sort of ubiquitous items, and they haven't really changed since 2006. The basic overall design of the Power Mac really hasn't. The insides have changed dramatically, but everything else has pretty much stayed the same. The new Mac Pro, which was announced a few months ago and was supposed to come out this month, is now only available for pre-order and has now been delayed to sometime in February or perhaps even March. And so people are already commenting on, you know, why are the delays coming and what parts are being delayed. Apple is already boasting that they can't keep up with the demand. And there must be a huge pent-up demand for this new Mac Pro. And also the first reviews are coming out, and CNET, which is sort of a benchmark for the industry and what their reviews are, their initial reviews are quite good. They said it was one of the most, that it sort of completely outpaced any other Windows workhorse desktop that they had seen that year. Everyone's wondering whether or not this design is going to take off. It's a radical departure. Old Mac users like myself or other listeners may remember the Cube, which was launched in 2000 to 2001. It was a commercial flop, if you will, because it had all sorts of production problems. It was a little bit of a PR nightmare, but people did love the design, and it has a cult following.
Absolutely.
The new Mac Pro, some people say it looks like the villain in one of the Star Trek movies. I think it looks like an ice bucket myself, but it is quite beautiful and quite sculptural. And you can easily, with just a few clicks of the button, spec it up to $10,000, and you haven't even bought a screen.
Wow.
So it starts at $3,000 and goes all the way up to $10,000. One of the really interesting parts of the Mac Pro is its ability to output up to three 4K displays simultaneously, thanks to its new Thunderbolt 2 ports. And 4K display is sort of the future of television and the way that we view film and TV and things like that. It's many years away, but the fact that they've already sort of given the next generation of creators the tools to do that, I think is quite interesting.
And I guess radical isn't a word we would often associate with Apple anymore, would you say? I mean, it's, you know, their designs, although still, you know, incredibly good, sort of slightly, they've lost the edge that they did a few years ago, and they would just bring out these new, most amazing innovations. Do you think design is still something we associate with Apple?
I think we do. And I think one of the problems when you have such a minimal device is how minimal can you go? Ultimately, the device disappears. And I think that's what we're seeing with Google Glass and things like that. But I think this new the new Mac Pro shows that they're still willing to take risks. Mm-hmm. This is definitely a risky design. But then again, at the same time, it's 1/4 the size, at least, of the old G5s. It's just amazing to see how far it's come. And it's also, according to Apple and according to reports, just as quiet as the Mac Mini.
Wow.
So if you can imagine, if you're a designer and you're recording sound or you're recording music and you don't want a very loud tower next to you with giant fans blowing all the time, something like this would be very welcome. But desktops are going away. Home users used to use desktops for, you know, photo imaging and playing games, and now we have tablets for that. So I think, and we have gaming systems, we have all sorts of things. So we don't really need desktop towers like we used to. But let's see. I mean, if you have $10,000, if I have $10,000 lying around, maybe I might buy the Mac Pro for myself.
And I'm sure graphic designers listening, the wealthy ones at least, will be forking out for that. Going back to New York, let's talk about the New York Times redesign that's just had happen.
Absolutely. Some of the users of the New York Times website may already be seeing a redesign that started on January 2nd, but everything else will go live supposedly on January 8th. The buzzwords here are white space and customization, and the third would be multimedia.
Wow. And what's it? I mean, it's a lot of clean white space, isn't it? The actual design of it.
Yeah, I mean, it won't come as a major shock. It's definitely, it looks like the New York Times website. There's certain points that I found to be really interesting in this. The first one being, this is another move towards changing websites into apps. Mm-hmm. And so the new New York Times website, because of its customization, will be more familiar to people of tablet devices and mobile devices. Things like multimedia will be able to be viewed bigger and larger and sort of fill the screen, if you will. It's meant to be a full screen experience, from what I can tell. And that's something that's definitely a trend. And there's a lot of new sites out there that are, you know, forgetting about the banner ad. They're forgetting about the header and the all sorts of the normal bells and whistles that you have to put up with. So essentially, this is a more HTML5, multimedia friendly, lots of white space, really letting the content breathe. And you can just tell that it's more of a move towards changing web pages into things that look more like apps.
Yeah. Easier on the eye, let's say that.
Easier on the eye. And it seems like they could possibly, in my opinion, be more concerned now with the paying subscriber rather than necessarily the advertiser or the person who's going to buy, you know, a small little micro banner ad somewhere.
Yeah. Dan, thank you as ever for joining us on Section D. Last year, Danish silversmith, jeweler and watchmaker George Jensen acquired Danish Silver, a dealer and retailer that specialised in pieces by the Copenhagen-based brand. It was an unexpected step, but one that cleverly brought some of the brand's most beloved heritage pieces back into the fold ahead of George Jensen's 110th anniversary, which it celebrates this year. Danish Silver founder Gregory Pepin, a Georg Jensen fanatic and collector, was also brought in as managing director of Hollow Silverware, overseeing the heritage collection. He recently took me through some of his favourite antique pieces at the Old Bond Street store in London, and also told me about the future of the brand as it celebrates its birthday.
I was the owner of a company called Danish Silver, which focused on vintage and new Georg Jensen. We started in some 15 years ago, and the business was based on customer service, retail client, and selling basically to avid collectors, designers, and first-time buyers as well. In lame terms, I'm perhaps an ambassador for Georg Jensen, on the working very much from a passion. In the beginning, it was not a business. It was not a business decision. It was more of a passion decision, and it actually became a business decision, and actually a very lucrative business decision. So, after the 1st of May, I became managing director for Georg Jensen for the silver department. And basically, what we're doing is it's been my life's dream to be able to work with our archives, take a lot of archive pieces that haven't been in production, reproduce them in very small amounts for our clients. And the way we find out which pieces our clients actually buy is by doing events such as we're doing on Bond Street this evening. What we do is we have a vintage department, which we call Georg Jensen Heritage. It is called Georg Jensen Heritage. So it's any secondary pieces, any secondary Georg Jensen pieces that we buy in the market. We show those at events. From there, we perhaps produce new versions of them.
Go back to the beginning of your sort of personal relationship with Georg Jensen. I mean, what have you been a collector for years and you just love the work, or how did it all sort of begin?
It actually began where I'm from Vermont originally, and I met my wife, who was Danish, who was a nanny at a girls' summer camp when I was working at a girls' summer camp. And I came to Denmark 22 years ago. I started working in a shop called Danborg, which was a major high-end shop in Denmark. The owner, Uffe Danborg, unfortunately passed away last year, but that was a very close friend of mine. He was my mentor, so to speak, for a lot of years. He had a passion for Jensen that I quickly adopted. I think anybody that works with Georg Jensen, I was actually started polishing silver in the shop. I started from completely in the bottom, polishing silver, learning Danish on the side. And then there was a lot of American tourists at the time. And at that time, there wasn't many Danish people that spoke Danish well enough in that shop, anyhow, our shop, that could sell to the Americans. And so one day when we had several people that were out of work sick, I happened to wait on the first customer that walked in the door, who turned out to be a very important person from the United States. I don't want to mention her name. And she ended up buying literally probably half of our inventory. We spent 6 hours together. The owner made a very wise decision, and I stopped polishing silver that day, and I started to become the person who was head of sales for the company as far as the silver goes. Believe it or not, I was in 1998 when I started my business, 1999, back in 1998-99. And if you look at it today, it would look pathetic, but we had a webpage, and it was actually, back then it was more PR. People weren't buying things in the web, but it was a great way of PR, and it actually improved our global presence for a little company as Danish Silver. Became very globally well known.
So if you could talk about the collection you're showing here today, I mean, what are some of your favorite pieces? What are the sort of the highlights of?
Yeah, let's get back to it. It's not just Holloware I'm crazy about. I have a huge passion for Jensen jewelry, because Jensen started by making jewelry. He was a very poor silversmith, you know, and to produce a piece of Holloware, the material was expensive, but the labor was not. So Jensen really didn't start producing Holloware until, he started in 1904, but until really 1906, very slowly, 1907, 1908, and, you know, right up until if you see any pieces pre-1910, the hallmarks are quite exceptional as well. It's quite rare. I have one piece here I can show you after. But and those early pieces are going to be silver pieces with stones in them as well, because they mimic a piece of jewelry, so to speak. He hadn't quite found himself at that time. One piece that a lot of people know, but I'm still, it's humbling to be able to talk about it, is the blossom pattern. It's my personal favorite still. And that was designed in 1906. Right around 1905, 1906. You know, the exact dates are not 100%, but some years run into others, because you start by designing a teapot, and by the time you design the tray, the tray was probably designed, or it is designed, several years after. The other piece that we have here on the jewelry part is I have a 18-carat freshwater pearl necklace I bought from a collector that Georg Jensen made himself in 1919 for a man called, his last name was Ragazzi, and he purchased it as a piece for his daughter-in-law, for his son's wedding in 1919. It was made by Georg Jensen himself in the original box.
I'm interested, sort of, as your position as a sort of outsider, to talk about the sort of the relationship between Denmark and silverware. Denmark's known for producing many, many things, silverware being one of them. What's your sort of opinion as an American emigre into the country?
I think the reason, first of all, why Denmark produces so many good designers is I think that the work ethic until maybe recently, because of everything that's going on in the world, the Danes have always, when they do something, they do it right or they don't do it at all. We have a 37-hour work week, which doesn't pressure you. Good design comes from not being pressured. I strongly believe that. I also believe that a really good design comes from generations of learning. At one time, George Jensen had 300 silversmiths, so some of the apprentice, if you were an apprentice at George Jensen in the 1930s, you trained under maybe 20 or 30 masters. This is our problem today. This is what we have to look at, because today we have a fraction of that of silversmiths, so if we have apprentices coming in, they're only going to get the knowledge of 8 or 10 silversmiths versus 300 silversmiths. Historically, why Jensen became so big, if we talk about North America, because I'm North American, I think the Jensen's, Denmark in general's position of being so popular in North America, Danish design, is from North Americans who left Denmark because of World War II and feel it necessary to come back. We had a king, King Christian X, who's pretty much a hero for a lot of people, who was a king during the World War II. It's a fantastic story of him riding across where the castle is, and under occupancy, the flag was taken down by some German soldiers, and he rode across on his horse himself and put the flag back up because he knew it would be a bad idea if they shot him. So, but it's that kind of patriotism in Denmark. It's that kind of, you know, as an American living in Denmark 21 years, I almost feel I'm half Danish. It can be something as to get away from Jensen, but can it be as something as a Danish football team playing with it? It's just this collective meaning or collective opinion that this is something that we all part of Denmark, you know, the fairy tale, so to speak, the Little Mermaid we have. And a lot of tourists come to Denmark because they want a bite or a piece of that fairy tale. And they buy a piece of Jensen because they want a piece of that history.
That was yours truly, chatting with Gregory Pepin of George Jensen at the company's old Bond Street store in London. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Coming up, we preview the design solutions to natural disasters in an upcoming New York exhibition, and our reporter in Taipei meets the minds behind the World Design Capital 2016. But first, let's head north of the American border. 87 years old, and Ebb Zeidler has spent more than half a century shaping the skyline of Toronto. The architect, who designed the downtown Eaton Centre, Toronto Centre for the Arts and Ontario Place, recently published his autobiography, a hefty 1,635-page tome entitled Building Cities Life. Monocle's Jason Lee chatted with him at his office. Yes, he still shows up for work every day. And learned how he stumbled into architecture, how he got to Canada, and his hopes for the city.
After the war, I worked in my brother's office and tried to get in a university, and it was very difficult because all the classes were filled, you know, with young people who wanted to start. And then I found there was a school in Weimar, and I went there, and they said, no, the first year is all filled, but the third semester, there are only 5 people in there because these were, you know, people that started the war and then were wounded or something like that, and very few left. And he said, if you had been at a university before, you could get in. And so I said, well, I have been, because I went to university as a little boy. My brother was studying there, and I went, and not as a student, but just as a high school student, I went, slipped school and went to university. And so my brother at this time was teaching at the university in Breslau, and he met his old professor, and he said, you remember my brother? Yes. You remember him at university? Yes. Well, he was there all the time. Oh, yes, yes, yes. So he signed the letter that I had worked at the university.
And after graduation, you stayed in Germany for a while to work as an architect.
I first found another teacher, Eiermann, and I worked with him. And then I I worked there. I escaped from East Germany to West Germany and then worked in Karlsruhe with Professor Eiermann. And he was a very, very famous man, but he came from a different direction, really. And I learned there kind of a different type of architecture. It was more the related to the older German architecture. And I did there several jobs, quite famous jobs that developed there, a hospital and also a factory and so on. From there on, I kind of got the idea that I maybe should travel through the world, because what was am I doing here, running an office of 25 people, and I'm only 23 years old.
You've been to so many countries, you've looked at so many cities. Which cities inspire you architecturally the most?
Well, each city has its own part, you know. I think Toronto is really growing up quite nicely. I think the European cities are something to behold. And, I love New York, I love Los Angeles, and each city has its own charm, and so you learn from them. And I mean, what really matters is really that we're still doing so many things wrong, you know. And I mean, while parts of Toronto are great, other parts of Toronto are not that great, you know, because they fall apart. Jane Jacobs was a great friend of mine, and I learned a lot from her. And she was talking about that cities are for walking and for people to be. And so you have to not create a city in different jargons, like a downtown and a this and that and that, but it should be always combined. Everything should be together, and poor people and wealthy people and everybody should live side by side. And that what makes a city alive, and that what makes city walking, and that why you can feel good in a city.
What do you think is the future of Toronto as a city?
Well, I mean, you can only hope that we learn something, but the sad part is that really you do something good and then it gets destroyed. And then finally you find something. Like Ontario Place was a beautiful place, but then the different people that ran it kind of destroyed it. They piddled around and did something wrong with it. And then somehow it collapsed. Now it's sitting there and nobody knows what to do with it. And it's sad, because it should be, again, a place for Ontario to have something to be proud of and to be there, to go there for the weekend or for a day and enjoy yourself. The worst part that destroyed Ontario Place was really the amphitheater that happened there. Mm-hmm. There was a forum, I don't know if you remember that, but the forum was a place where you could have 1,000 people have a good time, and small communities could enjoy themselves. But you could hold 16,000 people with the 1815 symphony, where 16,000 people were there and enjoyed themselves all at the same place. Now with this amphitheater, you have to have 20,000 people there and rock concerts or nothing. And that's a problem. Because it's noise, the restaurants that are around there and so on. So that is a problem.
If you could give one advice to younger architects trying to make their mark in cities around the world, what would your one advice be?
Well, I mean, just build and build right. It has everything has to be there. Not just, I mean, the small house and the big house, the high rise, all have to be together and make a city.
Eb Ziedler there. Up next after the break, we'll hear what building design can do in the face of natural disasters.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Hurricane Sandy in New York, the Fukushima disaster in Japan, and Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines are some of the growing number of natural disasters to have hit densely populated parts of the world over the past couple of years. These events claim many lives, in part because they had a devastating effect on the built environment. Now, in a show entitled Considering the Quake, Seismic Design on the Edge, put on by the American Institute of Architects and opening in New York in February, architects and scientists are exploring design solutions that could better equip our world's urban areas for what are becoming increasingly common major environmental events. Monocle's Haley Joel Ott spoke to Lance J. Brown, president of the American Institute of Architects in New York, about the show and its mission.
They're going to see a broad range of examples of buildings that illustrate the intersection between architectural, engineering, and programmatic design in the making of our architecture. So there will be specific projects from around the world that will be explained and explored in two-dimensional graphics. But there'll also be three-dimensional components of what make buildings resilient, and in fact, some working models, one item called a shake table, which will simulate what the effect of an earthquake is on a structure so that people become aware of why buildings are designed in the way they are to withstand that trauma.
What can the technologies that will be on view actually do to help a building in the event of some activity like an earthquake?
Well, I think suggesting that they may be there to help might not be the semantics. It's really an integration of structural resilience and aesthetics that make a building resilient to the effects of ground movement. It's not as if this, in that regard, is all totally new, but as we move into levels of greater scientific evaluation, greater ability to predict using big data, more sophisticated tools for the design of structural componentry, we get to use these tools to make more responsive architecture and often much more beautiful architecture. So whether these help or not is a question. I think as they are integral, I think they're just part of the larger goal of making appropriate architecture for the context.
And the show features buildings from China, from the US, from Italy. Are these sorts of technologies being used more increasingly internationally?
I think as we become more aware of the risks involved with earthquake hazards, these become more and more incorporated. In the United States, if you went back 20 years, you would see in the state of California, when they finally did determine what the potential was for earthquake damage, they spent a number of years just going through the buildings throughout the state and retrofitting them to make them resilient against earthquake possibilities. On the other hand, the country of Japan, having known the risks involved because of their geology, they have been leaders in preparing for earthquake disasters. And while there's nothing good to say about the tragedy of Fukushima, the fact is, had the Japanese not been as well prepared for this kind of disaster, the loss of life would have been so much greater. And so they, in a way, are a great bellwether for what one can do in advance. And at the same time, some of their architecture is so exquisite, in part because it has incorporated the most sophisticated earthquake countermeasures.
Is there anything that buildings that incorporate these countermeasures have in common aesthetically?
I think probably not. Much of what you can do can be either exposed and brought to the surface, or it can be kind of entrained and within the body of the work. Plus, I guess you could say, the aesthetics of the people involved with producing the buildings will use whatever technology is necessary to both make their buildings responsive, but make them responsive within the design culture that they've already established. An example of that, I think, would be the Jewish Museum in San Francisco by Daniel Libeskind. If you look at that building, there's little doubt that it's a product of the Libeskind studio. The fact that it happens to be in San Francisco, part of the California earthquake vulnerable area, was influential in terms of the structure of the building, and that will be nicely explained in the exhibit, but it certainly didn't cause Daniel Libeskind to design a building other than one that fits within his known portfolio. So in that case, it's not visible. On the other hand, there's a building in Japan, in Sendai, called the Sendai Media Tech, and that building is a totally progressive building designed to withstand earthquakes. And it doesn't seem to have very much of a precedent for it. When you look at the building, you don't say, well, that's derivative of even the designer's own work. So there's a broad range of possibilities. They are all very much wedded to the context in which the building is being built, to the degree of vulnerability, and to the aesthetics, and possibly even the budget of those producing it.
And the show is described as a science center for design. Does this sort of beg the question, is the line between science and design becoming more and more blurred as these sorts of technologies continue to develop?
Well, you know, one of the rubrics that I've heard applied to architecture specifically is it's a discipline that's the least scientific of the sciences and the least artistic of the arts. Not that I say I agree with either of that, but architecture lives so much on the seam between so many things that it must accommodate, that I think it has always been somewhat out front with certain technical and scientific achievements, but not always necessarily so. With regard to that, in 1923, Frank Lloyd Wright designed a building in Tokyo, the Imperial Hotel, which was one of the few major buildings to survive the Tokyo earthquake of 1923. The building actually also survived the bombing of the Second World War and was eventually taken down in 1968, so that because of the economy of the land development. But Wright's ingenuity in making a building that could somewhat float above the moving ground of the earthquake was innovative, technical, somewhat scientific, and showed the possibility of integrating in ways invisible great advantages to the architecture. This, by the way, is also true of the Sendai Media Tech, which is on a little YouTube clip, which I find to be one of the most extraordinary things to watch. It's 30 seconds on the inside of a shaking building. And we will show how buildings shake. I don't know that we'll show that building particularly, but that's part of the science of this, the ability to be specific and precise in the design of elements against known strains and stresses is certainly something that becomes more and more sophisticated with all of our new tools and all of our capacities.
Lance J. Brown of the American Institute of Architects in New York, talking to our very own Haley Joel Ott. Now to end the show, let's look towards the future. Following in the footsteps of cities including Helsinki and Torino, Taipei is World Design Capital 2016, the title handed down biannually by the ICSID, the International Council of Societies of Industrial Design. The 2016 choice came as a surprise to many. especially given the lack of design heritage in Taipei compared to past world design capitals. It was also the only city to contend for the title. But for those in the know, it was a logical fit and a landmark statement confirming the immense progress and rapid pace of modernisation that the city has experienced over the past few years. It's something they'll be working with the ICSID to continue in the run-up to 2016. In Taipei, Chris Fitch has more.
Everyone said, no way. Taipei is too ugly. It is not possible to become world design capital. And even the citizens, everyone feels, no, Taipei is a world design capital. No way.
It is statements like this which make it clear just what a significant step it was in November of last year when the ICSID announced Taipei with their winning slogan, The Adaptive City, as World Design Capital 2016. A city not traditionally thought of by many as a great ambassador for the world of design, suddenly having its moment in the spotlight. But as Irene Wu, director of the International Design Section of the Taiwan Design Center, explains, the awarding was more than just a judgment of the aesthetics of the city. It was the next step in a much wider national plan.
For Taiwan, we want to transform our industry from, of course, made in Taiwan to become more design in Taiwan. So that's the main mission, what we are doing right now.
As the numbers of top designers in Taipei has grown over the past few years, they have been increasingly questioning the design of the city all around them and considering how it could be planned better for the long term. It's a monumental shift, as the absence of design in Taiwanese city building throughout most of its recent history has been down to the collective attitude that it's all just for the short term, and that one day they will return to the Chinese mainland.
People always think about someday we'll go back to China, we'll get China back. After I become a designer, I think the history has been changing. We are not going back to China, and right now we just come to try to be a friend of China.
Kevin Chow is an award-winning product designer from Taipei, who has worked as a consultant for Taipei City.
At this moment, design is very important. Design needs to be part of this because we are not thinking about it to do the temporary things. We want to do a permanent things.
One example of how this attitude is changing the city can be seen in the new urban regeneration stations, a practice seen across much of the world, where abandoned buildings are given a second life by the design community.
They just open the space to the independent designers to set up their studios inside, and they can network together, and so the abandoned places and transform into a creative hub.
This is Wendy Chang, also from the Taiwan Design Center and project manager on the World Design Capital Development.
The quite famous one is UIS 21. It's just located in the Zhongshan districts. And from the hub, there's also a lot of independent creative shops located in the Zhongshan districts.
Noticeably though, there aren't many new constructions in the plans building up to 2016. Instead, the goal is to hone in on and tweak those small details about the city which have repeatedly been ignored.
So we are thinking to make everything more detailed. That will make difference. Let everyone, not only the designer, but also people and also government, everyone of government, think to make our public area more detailed.
Agua Xu runs the agency Agua Design. She and her team have been working on improving some of these details, such as creating smaller, more aesthetic street signs, as well as fashioning some rather smart new outfits with matching equipment for the Taipei street cleaners. All this using homegrown talent from within Taiwan.
You know, in Taiwan, we have many industrial designers and many fashion designers. But you can see our public area, we didn't use the designer profession very well. So I think it's the very star. From now on, government will think to cooperate with the designers and also communicate with the public citizens.
This communication with the public is arguably the core message which Taipei City is trying to include in their future planning. But it isn't all a one-way street. There is also a strong desire to make the citizens of Taipei think more about quality design in their own lives and businesses. Kevin Chow.
People in Taipei, they kind of get an idea Taipei is a design capital. So maybe in their daily life, and then they kind of have design thinking involved, and to have a better menus and have a better service, have the better graphics anyway. So the awareness of the people living in Taipei, I think, is very important. In the past, maybe they say, oh, design is not my business. Design is the people just doing the beautiful things and producing a nice product. But after they know, oh, we are the design capital, I think the education or the way people live, it will change.
Ultimately, being World Design Capital 2016 isn't necessarily about massive infrastructural changes across the city, but about Taipei opening its doors, being less humble, and showing everyone how much it already contributes to the world of design. For Monocle in Taipei, I'm Chris Fitch.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in this week's edition of Section D, our first for 2014. My thanks to our producer Aled John and Holly Fisher for her editing. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions or queries. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, after all that talk of natural disasters, here's I Feel the Earth Move by Carole King. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Month of May.